Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the announcement expected tomorrow by Obama's former ambassador to China, John Huntsman Jr., that he is going after Obama's job. Rocky Anderson, the former mayor of Salt Lake City, who knows both Mitt Romney and John Huntsman well, joins us to assess the man who many see as the most formidable and electable candidate Obama could face. We will discuss the inconsistencies between the former John Huntsman and the latest candidate to enter the Republican race for the presidential nomination. Then we will look into the staggering price of capital punishment in California, where the death penalty has cost the cash-strapped state more than $4 billion so far. Lori Levinson, professor of law at Loyola Law School, joins us to discuss the just-released study, Executing the Will of the Voters, a roadmap to mend and end the California legislature's multi-billion dollar death penalty debacle. Then finally, the editor of the OC Weekly, Gustavo Arellano, joins us. He writes a syndicated column, Ask a Mexican, and we will talk to him about what he sees as a shining example of the Tea Party's idea of a political paradise where taxes are low, where there is no Obamacare, and the rich are free to get richer and richer. The Tea Party's perfect country, large areas of which are government-free and ruled by those with the most money and guns, is, of course, Mexico. I'm now joined by Rocky Anderson, who was the mayor of Salt Lake City from 2000 to 2008. During his time in office, he became known as a progressive voice in Utah politics, including for the internationally renowned Salt Lake City Green Program, which drastically reduced the carbon footprint of the city's municipal operations. He currently serves as president of the Utah-based nonprofit organization High Road for Human Rights. Welcome to Background Briefing, Rocky Anderson.
Great to be with you. Thank you.
And I suppose John Huntsman, who's now, to some extent, since he's going to apparently step into the race tomorrow for the Republican nomination to become the next president of the United States, he perhaps will be running against his record. But it strikes me that he is really how Republicans used to be. He's moderate, fiscally conservative, reasonably liberal on social issues. He's not going to be getting the nomination for a party that's not the same party today, right? This is the party of the religious right and the Tea Party.
John Huntsman is the kind of Republican that my Republican parents would have been able to support. And actually, he was supported by a lot of Democrats here in Utah, including myself. I think he did an excellent job, stood up on some issues against our very right-wing legislature, and took some pretty controversial positions. It took a lot of guts in Utah, including support for domestic partnerships. Now, it's not going all the way that I would go in terms of marriage equality, but it certainly was, and pretty early on, relative to what we're seeing in this country in terms of asserting the legal rights, equal legal rights for gays and lesbians who decide to be committed partners.
Well, clearly, Rocky Anderson, the Utah Republican Party is fairly much captured by the Tea Party. I mean, there was a sitting United States Senate senator there, Senator Bennett, who didn't even face a re-election in the primary. He was booted out by the caucus.
Which was amazing when anybody could say that Bob Bennett was too liberal to be a United States senator. They're saying the same thing about Orrin Hatch. That's what it's like in Utah Republican politics, and it's what I'm afraid is getting to be more and more like the Tea Party and extremist Republican politics around the country, as they are leaning toward the fringe, rather nutty side, rather than supporting those who have been pretty good, and in my view, very, very conservative Republicans in the past. You know, what was interesting was with Bob Bennett, he was so criticized for his support of TARP when, in fact, TARP was a Bush program. It was a Republican program at the time. And that's they have very short memories, but I think there are a lot of political opportunists who feed on that sort of thing, feed on the ignorance and short memories of a lot of the people in this country and use it for their own political opportunities and benefit.
Again, I'm speaking with Rocky Anderson, the former mayor of Salt Lake City, who knows both Mitt Romney and John Huntsman Jr. personally. And, of course, John Huntsman Jr. is expected to enter the Republican race for president tomorrow. And obviously he's going to have a tough row to hoe if the Republican Party that you're describing there in Utah is anything like the national primary voters. But paradoxically, my understanding is that the Republican establishment think he's the most electable, and I think the White House thinks he's the most electable, don't they?
I think they do. I think they did everything they could to try to keep him out. And you know, it really says a lot about how partisan things have become in this country. When the Obama administration was complimenting John Huntsman for what he did as ambassador to China, as if that were going to be a bad thing for him in the Republican Party. They clearly don't want John Huntsman to receive the Republican nomination. And if Republicans were wise instead of the right-wing purists, if they would support somebody like John Huntsman, he would give President Obama a real run for his money, because I think there are a lot of moderates and even a lot of Democrats who are willing to vote for somebody like John Huntsman, regardless of party affiliation, because he's smart, he's capable, he's proven that he can be gutsy, that he'll stand up on certain issues, although apparently he's changing his position on a few issues. But nothing as dramatically as what we saw, I think, with Mitt Romney the day he decided to run for president. By the way, they're both friends. I like them both personally a lot. I'm just sorry to see that some people will become such political chameleons.
Well, how much is Huntsman backing away from the real John Huntsman as opposed to the candidate? I mean, he's in favor of gay unions, but not gay marriage, I understand. And he's anti-abortion, and he's backtracked on
anti-abortion. No, he hasn't changed his view on that like Mitt Romney did.
Right.
I mean, Mitt Romney to win the governorship of Massachusetts supported Roe versus Wade, and that I know that was Mitt's view, that Roe versus Wade was settled law and it works and we ought to just move on. Of course, today he decided to run for president. I think that his handlers persuaded him that he really needed to change his view on that, and on stem cell research and on gay rights, if he were to stand any prayer of getting past the Republican convention. John Huntsman, he does realize the importance of dealing with climate change. There is no question that he, as a person, knows how important that is. He supported the Western Climate Initiative, which was a regional cap and trade program. Of course, so did Mitt Romney initially before he backed away from that in Massachusetts. But I understand that Governor Huntsman, Ambassador Huntsman, has now backed away from cap and trade. But cap and trade isn't necessarily the only or the best solution on climate change. I think Governor Huntsman knows how much progress the Chinese have made on climate change. And in fact, I've studied this intensely, and I can tell you they're doing a lot more in China to deal with climate change over the long haul than we're doing here in the United States. And Ambassador Huntsman knows how important that is. But, yeah, we're not going to hear him support cap and trade, particularly during this campaign.
Well, Rocky Anderson, though, he has signed cables, which the WikiLeaks got hold of, as U.S. ambassador, praising China's efforts on addressing climate change through green technology. And he also, of course, praised in these cables, apparently praised President Obama and was proud to be a part of his team and felt that the healthcare reform was very important here in the United States. So you can certainly get the feeling that this stuff's going to come back to haunt him, right? And I'm not sure how much the White House is going to stir the pot here. Maybe they'll just let the Tea Party types do it because... Axelrod apparently tried to when Ambassador Huntsman visited the White House for the state business of Hu Jintao, Axelrod collared him and said, "What are all these rumors about you running for president?" And of course Huntsman said, "Oh, they're overblown," but apparently not.
No, he'll be announcing, and I think that as people get to know John Huntsman, they're going to see that we've got somebody that's principled, who's very bright, very experienced, very well-educated, very, very well-rounded. And, you know, we simply can't settle for the celebrity types, the people that somebody may want to go out for a beer with or even date, but who couldn't run a 7-Eleven down on the corner. And I think that's certainly the case with Sarah Palin, and Michelle Bachmann's not very much closer. In fact, I think with all of her gaffes, she's going to burn out very, very quickly. So I think it is going to be a Mitt Romney and a John Huntsman campaign for the nomination. And I've had the real honor of working very, very closely with both of them.
So, Rocky Anderson, you don't think that the country has gone down that path of arguably, you could call it sort of anti-intellectual populism, where you'd vote for the guy you have a beer with, like George W. Bush, or Sarah Palin, or a Michelle Bachmann. You're confident that there's enough educated people out there that want to vote for people who aren't just like them, but are actually more competent than they are?
Well, I wish I could say I were really optimistic that were the case. I'm hopeful. I guess I really wish that people in this country would become more informed and have more respect for reason and logic and science. But when people say the kinds of things that Michelle Bachmann and Sarah Palin have said, they're a joke. They shouldn't even be part of the equation at this point. And there's nothing that qualifies either of them to be president of the United States. On the other hand, you see people like John Huntsman and Mitt Romney, both of them business people. They've served in high executive elective office. John Huntsman's been a United States trade representative, ambassador to Singapore, and ambassador to China, which I think is probably the most important ambassadorship on the planet today. Yeah. And I think that we can be pretty pleased that there's that sort of competition out there. But certainly there is a real anti-intellectual trend in this country, which just really saddens me. And I think it's not limited to the young. It's not limited to those who are uneducated. I know very well-educated people who don't even read a newspaper anymore. They say they get it off the Internet, but I think they're reading The Onion more than they are The New York Times.
Well, Rocky Anderson, given that John Huntsman's junior, his father, of course, is a wealthy billionaire who owns a chemical company, which is one of the largest in the world, will... Huntsman finance his campaign?
Oh, I'm sure that he'll help finance his campaign, but I can tell you, John Huntsman Jr. grew up, and I know his family well, he grew up in a family that has as a primary ethic charity. John Huntsman Sr. has given, I believe it's somewhere in the neighborhood of $600 million toward cancer research. They've got the Huntsman Cancer Institute here in Salt Lake City. This is a man who really does walk the talk. I knew him before he probably had his first $1 billion, when he was sort of starting out in the business world. And he'd worked in the Reagan White House. And I remember him telling me, even at that time, how important it was to him that as people are earning their money, they're giving it away. And I think that's the ethic that John Huntsman Jr. grew up with. And I think that what he's doing now, and I know this may sound naive, but I think this is one of those cases where he's willing to give a tremendous amount of himself in order to do good public service. I think he wants to make the world a better place, as his mother and father have done for decades.
And just in closing then, in the last few minutes here, Rocky Anderson, again, mayor of Salt Lake City from 2000 to 2008, and who knows both John Huntsman Jr. and Mitt Romney personally. John Huntsman Jr. is expected tomorrow to enter the presidential race, and according to Mayor Anderson, it'll be a race between Mitt Romney and John Huntsman. Now, you were a little critical of Mitt Romney. I spoke to a veteran reporter with the Boston Globe the other day who's covered him for years, and his concern about him as a presidential candidate was that he says, you know, as a reporter, I can roam the corridors of the State House and the Capitol in Washington and call up politicians at any moment and have a real conversation with them, and that's what politicians do. But people out of the corporate world are used to corporate security, used to being in the boardroom where people can't get in, used to putting out press releases and commercials about what a great job they're doing, and they're not used to dealing with the people. So if Mitt Romney were to get elected president of the United States, would he act as the CEO of the United States?
Well, don't forget, Mitt Romney was governor of the state of Massachusetts,
true.
And
yeah.
It was very accessible. And in fact, I was at a conference of mayors meeting in Boston, and John Kerry was on the program, was supposed to speak, backed out at the last minute. I was able to make one call, get a hold of Mitt Romney, and he dropped everything and came over and gave the most rousing speech. And by the way, I'm a Democrat.
I know you are. Yeah.
I'm left of Democrats. I don't even claim Democrats anymore because I think they've been such cowards in the face of so many issues that are facing our country. But I so admired Mitt Romney. He comes in. Most of these big city mayors were Democrats. He got a standing ovation. Mayors cheering for him. He can be very inspirational. He's very smooth. And he's a very affable guy and a great sense of humor that I don't think comes across very well in the public. And I can tell you his wife, Ann, both these candidates' wives, both Mary Kay Huntsman and Ann Romney, are as pleasant and as good people as you'll ever meet.
Well, I thank you for sharing with our audience your inside knowledge of these people that are running for president. And in the case of the man who's going to put his foot in the race tomorrow, more than his toe in the water, who we see on these commercials riding around on an all-terrain vehicle, although apparently it's not him, I think it's going to be an interesting campaign, don't you?
It's going to be very, very interesting. And again, I just hope that we have a good dialogue on the real issues and that we stop these ridiculous circus sideshows like Michelle Bachmann and Sarah Palin and some of the rest of them.
Again, I thank you for joining us.
Thank you. It was a real pleasure.
Bye-bye. And hello again, I'm Ian Masters. I was just speaking then with Rocky Anderson, who's the former mayor of Salt Lake City from 2000 to 2008. And he is now president of the nonprofit organization High Road for Human Rights. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking about how the cash-strapped state of California is spending billions on capital punishment. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. I'm now joined by Laurie Levinson, who holds the David M. Burcham Chair of Ethical Advocacy at the Loyola University School of Law, Prior to joining Loyola Law School, she served for 8 years as an assistant U.S. attorney in Los Angeles. She has written widely on criminal law, focusing both on criminal procedure and on the relationship between the law and the media. Welcome to Background Briefing, Laurie Levinson.
It's my pleasure to be with you.
And, Laura, it's just extraordinary to learn that this cash-strapped state of California, where teachers are being furloughed and there's an expectation of deeper cuts because, as you know, the budget, governor vetoed the budget that was pretty draconian at any rate. And it presumably will be more so next time around, to think that the state has spent $4 billion so far on the death penalty and by 2030 will have spent $9 billion with 1,000 people on San Quentin's death row. I'm left with this thought that maybe this will be the beginning of the end of capital punishment. It'll be like nuclear power. It will die a fiscal death as opposed to a moral death.
Well, I think that's quite possible, because I think once the public knows how much the death penalty costs and how little it's actually used, they're going to have to sort of look at it very carefully and say, is it worth it? I mean, we've had 13 executions since we brought the death penalty back to California. That works out to about $300 million per execution. I bet there are other things we could do with that money.
And so how does it compare to the state of Texas, do you know?
Well, the state of Texas is number one in executions, and there have been over 1,200 executions in the country since 1976, and the majority of those are Texas. So Texas does things differently, but here in California, we are currently on a moratorium. We haven't figured out how to have a legal constitutional execution, and yet we keep putting people on death row, and just putting them on death row costs us millions of dollars.
So give us an idea, Laura Levinson, of why it costs $184 million a year.
Well, it's about 10 to 20 times more expensive to have a death penalty trial than it is an ordinary murder trial. And the reason for that are the protections we put in to make sure that we don't wrongfully convict people, because you know what, we have, and we continue to do so. And so there are two phases to a death penalty case, the guilt phase and the punishment phase. There are daily transcripts, two sets of lawyers, two sets of habeas corpus, automatic appeals to California Supreme Court. Then you have to have a whole new appointment of lawyers. It's a very expensive proposition.
And the study that was just released by the authors, the U.S. Ninth Circuit Judge Arthur Alarcon and Loyola Law School Professor Paula Mitchell, who's a colleague of yours, the title of the study is Executing the Will of the Voters, a Roadmap to Mend or End California Legislators' Multi-Billion-Dollar Death Penalty Debacle. Who's the audience in the minds of the authors for this report?
The audience is clearly the voters. I mean, the judge and Paula Mitchell, who is an adjunct professor but also the judge's clerk, spent 3 years doing the research on this. And you need to know that Judge Alarcon himself is not a raging liberal. He's, by and large, a conservative judge. He served as a prosecutor himself. But I think he was very troubled that the public, the voters, had never been given the straight information about the death penalty. All they're ever asked in these initiatives is, do you want to have more death penalty? And the voters click yes. And they have no idea what the cost is and the lack of effectiveness. So this was the goal, to get out in front of the voters the information they need.
And how did they get this information? Because it hasn't been accessible before.
Well, people who did the studies went ahead and contacted a range of sources, from government sources to defense lawyers who handle death penalty to the Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation. They scoured the landscape for information on the cost. And even doing that, there were some figures they couldn't get. For example, no one seems to be keeping statistics on just how many death penalty trials we have. We know how many lead to a conviction and an appeal, but we don't even know how many of the cases are out in the California courts.
Well, we know that there are 714 death row prisoners as of this moment, right?
That's right, and we know that it increases all the time. I mean, the great irony in this is that the courts cannot keep up with the flow of death row inmates. So last year, the California Supreme Court, that has to decide all these death penalty appeals, worked at a good clip. They decided 23 cases, but of course we added 33 more inmates to death row. And here's something that's a little scary that comes out of this report. The authors of the report say, you know, it's not just a matter that we have so many people on death row. We actually have people there who have meritorious claims on their appeals. About 70%, 70% of the federal petitions are actually successful on some issue. And yet these inmates are dying before the courts can decide their cases.
So why is there then, I guess it's a state issue, right? There's no, because I was very struck recently by Justice Stevens, some of his sort of regrets over the years. One of them was how the death penalty came back. So it's always obviously been a federal issue, but it's handled differently on a state-to-state basis, right?
That's right, because back in the early 70s, the U.S. Supreme Court had an opportunity to strike down the death penalty per se as cruel and unusual punishment. They decided not to do so. Instead, they've been narrowing the category of defendants who are eligible. So now no longer can minors receive the death penalty, and mentally retarded defendants cannot get it. And if you haven't committed a homicide, you can't get it. But we continue to have the death penalty, which means that it's up to the states. And one of the interesting things is as the states look at the cost and they look at the prisons filling up, they're abolishing the death penalty. New Mexico, New Jersey, Illinois, all put together commissions and have decided it's not worth it.
And what about looking at the rest of the world? I mean, isn't the United States alone with China and Iran and Saudi Arabia and some very unsavory regimes?
That's absolutely right. In fact, the European Union doesn't let any country in that has the death penalty. So we've been subject to a lot of world criticism because we maintain the death penalty. Now, this article doesn't per se say get rid of the death penalty. It just says take an honest look and think about what the alternatives are. You know, if you want to have the death penalty, maybe you want to narrow it to a very narrow group of crimes where people are killing police officers or multiple murders or killing judges and jurors. But you don't want to have what we currently have in California, which are 33 crimes that are eligible for the death penalty, including things like train wrecking. I mean, as they said, it's just too many with not enough focus on who you actually want to use this costly system for.
Again, I'm speaking with Loyola University Law Professor Laurie Levinson. We're talking about the report just issued authored by the U.S. Ninth Circuit Judge Arthur Alarcon and Loyola Law School Professor Paula Mitchell, Executing the Will of the Voters, a Roadmap to Mend or End the California Legislature's Multi-Billion-Dollar Death Penalty Debacle. And as of now, the death penalty has cost the cash-strapped state of California $4 billion, and by the year 2030, it will have cost $9 billion. But I suppose, Laurie Levinson, you have to doesn't this open up a broader discussion about the price of justice in this case, if indeed justice is the appropriate word? I mean, I spoke the other day to professor in the UC system who's quit in protest at these cuts that the legislature have just enacted on what was once the, you know, a world class university system and the envy of the world, and he was lamenting how much we're cutting education, and how yet in the period then we went from about number one in the country in terms of the state of California's educational system to, I think we're sharing the bottom now with Mississippi. That in this period the prison industrial complex has grown up, and it's taking the lion's share of the money. So in effect, we are dumbing down our kids, not giving them the education they need. At the same time, we're jailing the poorest of our citizens.
Oh, that's absolutely right. And, you know, the investment we're making to do this more, people have to take a look at. I mean, the governor has said he plans to redo death row up at San Quentin, which, by the way, is a prime piece of property if they should ever use it for the death row. So that's going to cost $1 billion. in order to redo death row. And there are trade-offs. That's what this article says, that the voters, frankly, should know of these trade-offs, and that the voters, since the legislatures really haven't done anything, that the voters should make that decision. They should decide, what do you want to do with this money? Do you want to use it on the death penalty? Or, as you suggested, maybe it's time to invest in education.
So you're a former federal prosecutor, and I think a lot of people are probably getting their legal education from these plethora of TV shows like Law and Orders. You know, now there's one in Los Angeles, by the way. You often see in these TV shows that the prosecutors use the death penalty as extra leverage, that there is actually some value to that threat. Now, from my point of view, just as a layperson, I would think that given the nature of how brutal the prisons are in this country, and Amnesty International, I think, on a number of occasions has criticized the U.S. prison system on the human rights basis, my understanding is they're pretty hideous places, and you're lucky to come out of there alive. The idea that life imprisonment is not a greater deterrent than the death penalty escapes me.
Well, I don't think there are any studies that actually support a finding that the death penalty is a deterrent. And in fact, I believe it's the ACLU is pushing for a change in terms. Instead of saying that death penalty and life without possibility of parole, why don't we just say death penalty or death in prison? Because eventually these people are going to die in prison. And, in terms of putting it to the voters, when voters are asked, do you want a death penalty? A majority in the country will say yes. But when the question is framed differently, when they're said, question is, would you like life without the possibility of parole? That means no possibility of parole, then they're more eager to choose that option. So it's really how open and intelligent the debate is. And you're right. I mean, these television shows and also politicians, they just talk about the death penalty as a slogan. Let's be tough on crime. They never get into the nitty-gritty of, regardless of whether you like the defendant or not, how does it affect society, what does it cost, what trade-offs are you making?
And it seems that the only thing that's changed people's mind, those that have supported the death penalty, have been the considerable number of people that have been freed from death row. Because the most famous project was out of Northwestern University. I take it it has some problems now, the Innocent Project, because of the actions of somebody involved, which hopefully the messenger won't taint the message, which is often the case. But what's your understanding of how from having been a prosecutor and obviously knowing the federal bench, that argument is persuasive? That you can be for the death penalty, but how could you be for something that is so randomly applied and sometimes misapplied that an innocent person could be executed? And clearly, there's no recourse once you press the button.
Well, I do think that that's a terribly important point, and the public should know that there were many documented cases, well over 100, of people who are actually innocent who ended up facing execution. In fact, we had a very famous case this year, Connick versus Thompson, where the defendant was wrongfully convicted. Prosecutors sat on some exculpatory evidence. He came within days of being executed, and finally he was exonerated. And when you talk about the cost of justice, people have to pause and say, and I did this as a prosecutor too, what is the cost of convicting and then executing an innocent person? That's immeasurable. So there are costs either way that you go. I just think that, on the death penalty here, more knowledge is important. And on the federal side, which you keep mentioning, I think for good reason, they actually have a much more narrow approach to the death penalty. When I was a federal prosecutor, we didn't even have an operative death penalty. And we did our best with the rules and laws that we had. I don't think that we had teeming death crimes that were occurring. They limit it to really the worst of the worst.
But am I correct, Lori Levinson, in remembering the remarks by the retired Justice Stevens, that he was sort of mystified how, in a way, or caught by surprise that the death penalty didn't go away and that it came back. And I'm curious to know how it came back and what kind of lobbying effort was involved.
Well, I think there's been a pendulum swing. I mean, there was a time when Justice Blackmun said he would no longer tinker with the machinery of death. He says we just can't get it right, no matter how hard we try and how many processes we have. So it looked like then the pattern would be to get rid of the death penalty by chiseling away at certain types of crimes. Frankly, I think it's the political movement, and there has been a strong conservative political movement that said you can't get rid of the death penalty, that's being soft on crime. I think that's actually a false argument. I think you can be very strong on crime. As a prosecutor, I hope I was really tough on crime. That doesn't mean you want to invest $4 billion in a death penalty system that doesn't seem to work.
And seems to be unevenly applied. I mean,
unevenly applied. I mean, one thing we haven't talked about yet is the issue of race. And we know for sure on these studies that if you kill a white person, you're four times more likely to be given execution than if you kill somebody of color. So we are actually devaluing lives. More people of color are disproportionately in the criminal justice system. That's a cost as well.
Well, I thank you for joining us, Laurie Levinson,
and
filling us in on this study and the sticker shock that this cash-strapped state has over the death penalty.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Let's now take a brief station break. Let me remind you that I was just speaking then with Laurie Levinson, who holds the David M. Burkham Chair of Ethical Advocacy at the Loyola University School of Law. Prior to joining Loyola Law School, she served for 8 years as an assistant U.S. attorney in Los Angeles. She has written widely on criminal law, focusing both on criminal procedure and on the relationship between the law and the media. Now we're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking about the Tea Party's paradise south of the border, Mexico. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. I'm speaking with Gustavo Arellano, who is the managing editor of the OC Weekly. He's also the author of the popular syndicated column Ask a Mexican, which won the 2006 Association of Alternative News Weeklies Award for Best Column in a Large Circulation Weekly. Welcome to Background Briefing, Gustavo Arellano.
Hola, Ian.
How are you? And your piece on Ask a Mexican about the Tea Party and how the paradise for the Tea Party appears to be Mexico, south of the border, has gotten some very interesting reactions. Have you had any Tea Partiers in your face?
Well, the question was, it was actually two people asking a question, both of them trying to make the point. One was an actual Tea Partier, if I remember correctly. Another one was somebody who hated the Tea Party, but they were both making the point that somehow Mexico, or at least the Mexico in the imagination of Americans, would be something that the Republicans and the conservatives in this country are trying to turn this country into, namely a country with no government whatsoever, no regulations, no care for humanity, really just this dog-eat-dog dystopian wasteland. And in my response, of course, I was a bit sarcastic. My columns always likes to play the devil's advocate. And I said, yes, Mexico is a Tea Partier's paradise. There is no trust of government whatsoever. The government that does exist is corrupt. It's exactly like the Republican Party here in the United States. So all Republicans should move to Mexico.
Large areas of which, of course, are run by people with the most money and the most guns.
Exactly. It's a plutocracy, and that's what the Republican Party wants and the Tea Partiers want in this country. It's a government run by those who can afford to run the government, while the rest of us grovel for the scraps and fight with each other for them like a big pack of dogs.
So, Gustavo Arellano, I wondered at the time of George W. Bush, which, you, as you probably recall, went on for 8 years.
Yeah, I try not to recall.
It was mystifying from the outset, and it continued to be mystifying. And when he was reelected, it was quite extraordinary. And I think the rest of the world said, okay, you guys are on your own. You know, first time around, it was an accident. This time, you actually put him in there. But the long and the short of it was, I could never figure out why Bush's agenda in terms of, you know, he came across as a regular guy, but his agenda was entirely plutocratic, entirely about crony capitalism, and he was all for the inheritors and investors, and he changed America to benefit them immeasurably.
Absolutely.
As we know. So I remember speculating, I'm thinking, well, what do they want? Do they want this country to be third world? Are they actually jealous of the kind of Mexican plutocrats like Carlos Slim who, you know, if they see a beautiful beach in a national park, they can put a mansion down there. If a young hooker slash actress ends up dead in bed with him, she disappears.
Or you have somebody like the former mayor of Tijuana, Jorge Hank Ron, who was arrested, I think it was a couple of weeks ago, with a cache of weapons, 88 semi-automatics and all sorts of, it's a whole arsenal. Now, what would a good businessman need with a whole arsenal? And everyone knows down in Tijuana that Jorge Hank Ron is about the shadiest of characters. The great newspaper there set that for the past, I think, 20 years. They've been running an ad saying, Jorge Hank Ron, why did you kill one of our journalists? And yet 2 weeks later, all of a sudden, Ron's free, you know, free to run. And so what does he do? He goes off and holds a party for all his politicos. That's exactly like how, you know, that's what the Republicans for the past, God, well, even beyond, before Bush, going back to Reagan, really, that's how they've imagined people should live. Although I do have to say, and this is scary for me to say, but in George W. Bush's defense, at least, you know, when it came to the question of immigration, at least he understood that Mexicans are actual human beings too, that Mexicans should be afforded, you know, some sort of dignity in this country when they try to migrate to the United States. This latest batch of Tea Partiers, they don't even give that sort of nicety to Mexicans. So only the Tea Partiers could make the W administration seem downright progressive by comparison.
Well, Gustavo Arellano, the border issue, of course, is peculiar in terms of its political alliances, because you have left-wing labor unions in bed with right-wing nativist Tea Party types, and then you have right-wing Chamber of Commerce people in bed with left-wing MALDEF people. So
yeah.
It's a strange mix, but I don't understand why nobody's ever pointed out the example of the European Union. And actually, it's a win-win when you have less of a border as opposed to more of a border. And, you know, they spent billions on this useless fence anyway.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, and then that, what that happens, no border, that unites libertarians with, you know, the more Aslanista types like myself, you know, who doesn't believe really in borders. But that would never happen. And let's not forget, though, or let's put it this way. The United States believes in borders unless they're of the economic sense. In that case, you create free trade unions like NAFTA, which decimated Mexico. And let's not forget that NAFTA was pushed forth by Republicans, sure, but signed by the Democrat Bill Clinton. So with the issue of immigration, I mean, you have all sorts of alliances, but with the issue of plutocracy, I do believe that's a very, you know, that's one of the crown jewels of the conservatives.
Well, but that's, I don't understand the politics of this country, why the Democrats can't create a narrative around the fact that that we are, I think, almost at warp speed becoming a plutonomy run by oligarchs. And you've seen the political power of the Koch brothers and others. Who, interesting enough, I talked to just earlier in the program, I talked to the former mayor of Salt Lake City, who knows John Huntsman well. He's the son of a billionaire, but apparently they have some kind of conscience about giving back to communities and charity, as opposed to spending their money on setting up AstroTurf Tea Party movements to get all these people to vote against their interests so that you can get rid of the EPA and pollute the air and make zillions more than you're already making.
Yeah.
What I find extraordinary, though, is that it seems to be so evident that we're returning to a new Gilded Age, and yet everybody prides themselves on the American dream and the great American middle class. Why can't that be a narrative in this country to something that... you know, let's restore the American dream.
Because we are now in a globalist age. The you know, we've been so, neutered is not the term, more like lulled into sleep in terms of class consciousness. We no longer, as long as we have the goodies that corporations send us, whether it's a wireless internet connection or a television or, hey, you know, good cheap food, that keeps us happy. We honestly, especially in this country, even, you know, for the most part, most people are not struggling. Even if they are, they really think that they're somewhat well off. I think things need to get much worse before they can get much better. And I don't know if most people want to see this country getting even worse off than it currently is right now. Although I think when you have more bailouts, more, you know, non-prosecution of people who, you know, of bankers and people who put us in this mess in the first place, I think the typical American working man and woman will see that as an outrage. Unfortunately, the Republicans, you know, conservatives, they somehow turn it into that, well, it's the fault of the Democrats, it's the fault of the liberals, and we need actually more deregulation instead of actual any watchdogs to guard from this happening again. I mean, you've been seeing that since the Great Depression with the, you know, the transformation of FDR into somebody almost as big of a tyrant as Stalin or Hitler.
Well, what's so ironic, though, Gustavo Arellano, is that that the Chinese, and this, in fact, in one of these Huntsman cables that WikiLeaks leaked when he was ambassador to China, he was pointing out that in his speech recently, he was pointing this out too, that China will have a bigger middle class than the entire United States. So here we are becoming third world, and even the billionaire Warren Buffett said that we're heading to a plantation economy. So you'd think that maybe that might wake us up, you know?
Oh no! Even if that were to wake us up again, they're going to put the blame on, they're going to put the blame on liberals. They're going to put the blame on progressives. They're going to immediately it's a disgusting double-edged sword because they'll say, they'll look at China, they'll look at India, they'll look at other economies, Brazil even, all these former third world countries that are now rising up, you know, with their own technological advances. And they'll say, well, we can't have, you know, we must dig for oil, or we must drill for oil wherever it is, because look at these other countries. They're not regulating anything. They're just like it's all free trade, free commerce. Of course, those countries are going through, as you said earlier, their own gilded age. Yeah, at one point in the United States, we had unlimited resources. And guess what happened? We used them up so fast because we didn't have any foresight to conserve them that we put ourselves in the situation that we are now, where oil prices are so high, where we were, despite us, almost 110 years relying on the combustible engine, we've yet to create an alternate. It's insanity. It's absolute insanity. And it's a guaranteed ticket into a very bad world.
So, again, I'm speaking with Gustavo Arellano, who is the managing editor of the OC Weekly. He's also the author of the popular syndicated column Ask a Mexican, and he was musing on that column about how, ironically, Mexico could be the paradise for the Tea Party, and that the United States could end up, if under Tea Party rule, mirroring a country where you have no regulations, no business codes, no social safety net, you have oligarchs in charge, you have guns and violence ruling, and of course the recent example of the mayor of Tijuana being arrested with a house full of guns and then let go. By the way, you know, years ago I did worked for Frontline, looked into the assassination of Colosio down there in Tijuana.
Oh yeah,
and boy, that kept coming back to Hank Rahn.
Exactly,
and that's why the Zeta guy was shot, by the way, because he had he had made those links as well.
Mm-hmm. Exactly, and yet Rahn walks the street free. He has his little race. Racetrack there. He has his businesses there. He was mayor of Tijuana, for crying out loud. And that's what's happening. And
he could have been governor of the state, you know. He almost won.
With the free, yeah. And in fact, I mean, the way this country's going, I would, you know, if it wasn't for the fact that you do have all that narco violence down there, I think there'd be more people, not just Mexicans, but also Americans, going down to Mexico, because despite all of its, you know, all of the things wrong with Mexico, in some parts it's actually still better than the United States in terms of, if you want to get off the grid, for instance, hey, you know, that's a perfect place to go to, because there's still going to be some places that haven't been touched by rampant development. Although I have to say, even in Mexico, you have had an explosion of development in terms of, you know, mansions and bland suburbia in like Tijuana and the bigger cities, Monterrey, Guadalajara. And that's just the Mexican middle class there trying to ape Americans.
Well, just in closing, Gustavo Arellano, let me get a sense of, though, because it seems to me that given that the huge disparity in wealth and the few families that have controlled Mexico for so long, and with one of the richest men in the world, Carlos Slim Alou, being able to own most of the country, and people and the country's been exporting its poverty here to the United States, but it seems to have, through the media, which Televisa and others have controlled, it seems to have really discovered how to get people to vote against their interests, particularly to vote for the PRI party. And every time the PRD wins, of course, they steal it from them. But but it seems to me that that's what the Tea Party is really about. It's about working Americans voting against their interests and being what useful idiots for the Koch brothers who are laughing all the way to the bank. So do you think that the U.S. is going to borrow the Mexican media model?
Oh, they have. Are you kidding me? That's the two-party political system in this country. It's you pour a lot of money and you try to convince people to vote against their own interests. At one year or one term it's a Republican, the other term it's a Democrat, but it's all ultimately coming from the same spigot, and it's all ultimately reported by the same media that will have these, you know, what is it, the White House Correspondents' Dinner, where everyone's all friendly and happy, and then the following day you all go and like try to screw each other over. That's the American way, and frankly, that's disgusting.
Well, but the sort of mindless stuff that you see, you know, with scantily clad women and people dressed up as clowns and all, you know, it feels so like bread and circuses. And our news is becoming infotainment. We seem to be more interested in how many times Lindsay Lohan gets arrested than and how we're going to get out of this economic mess.
Oh, sure. But let's not forget that Hedda Hopper and Luella Parsons was, you know, also functioned as basic, you know, as quote-unquote serious journalists during the 50s and 60s. So to romanticize investigative reporting or the news of this country, I think it's a bit myopic, just because, you know, the press here has always been in the mainstream press has always been in the pockets of, you know, people like Otis Chandler, and always will be.
Well, thank you so much for joining us here in Los Angeles, Gustavo Arellano, who's the managing editor of the OC Weekly, also has the popular syndicated column Ask a Mexican. I'd like to thank producer Spencer Downing, Kim Nassiter, and assistant producer Graham Fitzgibbon. I'll be back again tomorrow with another background briefing. Bye for now.